This episode of Designed by Architectural Record is brought to you by Vitro Architectural Glass. Make glass do more. SolarVolt building integrated photovoltaic glass integrates into structures of buildings to generate clean energy. It's CO2-free power generation, design element, and building component all in one. Supercharge your next project with SolarVolt BIPV modules by Vitro Architectural Glass. Get to know the possibilities at vitrosolarvolt.com. That's vitrosolarvolt, as in voltage, .com. Also, this episode of Designed is sponsored by CertainTeed Architectural. The interiors you create are more than mere spaces, and the ceilings and walls you use to create those spaces are more than mere surfaces. They bring visual warmth, comfort, and awe to interior spaces. They offer aesthetic beauty that inspires creativity and contributes to the well-being in offices, schools, medical facilities, hotels, and more. They offer acoustic benefits that help workers focus, students learn, and patients heal. So it's critical to work with a partner that understands the importance of ceiling and wall design and has a portfolio and technical experience to help you create without limits. That's where CertainTeed Architectural comes in. CertainTeed Architectural helps you solve building problems creatively and efficiently while tackling the most demanding challenges in design, acoustics, installation, engineering, and innovation. From economic and acoustical panels and suspension systems to unique ceiling showpieces in metal, felt, fiberglass, and wood, CertainTeed Architectural has the right solution for every space and every budget. All with the backing of design consultants, technical experts, and world-class customer support that can help unleash the creative potential of every project. They'll manage the details so you can focus on pushing the boundaries of ceiling and wall design. With CertainTeed Architectural, there are no limits to your design vision.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. We appreciate you listening, and once finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. If you'd like to learn more about Designed and see all the other great content that Architectural Record has to offer, please visit architecturalrecord.com for more information. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed by Architectural Record. I'm your host, Aaron Prinz. As always, I just want to say thank you to everyone out there for the reviews on the iTunes review section. It really means a lot. And that's actually the easiest way for us to get the podcast out to more people. So if you're enjoying it, even if you're not, stop by, leave us a comment, give us a rating, and we really appreciate it. Of course, be sure to check out architecturalrecord.com and follow us on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up, because we have some really great episodes. We have Todd Williams, Billy Chan. We have OMA. The list is growing and growing and growing, and you're not going to want to miss some of these interviews coming up. This week's episode, we have Elaine Molinar of Snohetta, who was an absolute joy to talk with. And we go into a lot of things, you know, the SF MoMA addition to their underwater restaurant, and of course, the new addition to the Blanton right here at the University of Texas at Austin, her alma mater, my alma mater. So we got to kind of converse about that a little bit. So it's really, really, really interesting. And, you know, to hear the origin stories of Snohetta and how this whole thing came about, anyone out there that's thinking about starting a firm and wants to use this as a template, you really need to pay attention to this episode because it's really great. So without further ado, I don't want to spoil anything too much. So sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Elaine Molinar. So we had Chris Sharpless on here of Shop probably, I don't know, it feels like forever ago, about 2 years ago. And I think he was saying when they started their firm that they were actually doing like as builds of gaps in the mall or something like that. And they were just like having to like measure all the spaces of the gap inside the mall. And he was saying, though, they would do some of those until they earned enough money. And then they'd step back and do a competition. And he was saying, we heard Snohetta, that's how they did it. So we were just copying Snohetta. And this is back, you know, it's so funny because you guys are all now in this sort of legion of Starkitects, to use the word. But can you just kind of go over, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s? Because everyone now, it's really easy to look at the internet and the work to me just kind of bleeds together. Like you can't tell who's doing what. It all kind of looks the same in some regard. So one, let's just start with, what was this role of competition in kind of the story of Snohetta? And then if you're looking at, you know, setting yourself apart in a competition, what was the take on that?
Well, obviously the Alexandria Library competition was a big one that had a huge impact in sort of kickstarting the practice that we are today. That was a big international competition. It was anonymous. It was open. students were eligible. You know, it was, everybody was eligible for that. And it was pretty exciting. So winning that, of course, you know, meant everything and created the seeds of who we are today. I think the design proposal that we came up with was very powerful as a work of design. But I remember that the competition boards that we created were very bold. They were not overloaded with information. So they were very clean. They had a lot of white space. You know, they stood out, I'm sure, amongst all of the other entries. And in fact, several years after the competition, a book was published of all of the entries that were judged. You could tell they were just jam-packed with imagery. And, you know, the designs were as well very occupied a lot of the site. For example, and ours didn't. So ours was very clear, I think, easy to understand, easy to look at in terms of a competition entry in front of a jury.
Well, was the goal to, because I mean, I'm sure that wasn't the first competition that you all entered. So was there this time when you're entering competitions and you're just not mm-hmm. getting it? And was there sort of like, should we pivot, or was it always just like, this is the focus?
Well, it kind of was the first competition, and it was certainly the first competition for the group of people that we were, that came together to do this. So, you know, I think the power of the reviving the ancient Library of Alexandria, that held a lot of that held us together, I think, because it was such a big thing, you know. And then when, you know, we continued our, we developed our practice in Norway, in Oslo, where our Norwegian colleagues had a studio. And competitions is a very common way of getting work in Europe. So, and we've done hundreds since, you know, in the 30 plus years that we've been around, there have been hundreds of design competitions that we've done. We evolved from doing mostly unpaid and uninvited competitions to invited competitions to paid competitions, and because it's a lot of time, it's a lot of investment, and they don't, you know, you don't always do your best work. Sometimes you do your best work and sometimes you don't, but you know, it's a learning process. So that competitions play a big role in general, I think, in Europe. And here in the United States, there are design competitions, but not as many, and we get a lot of our work through selected shortlists. Sometimes there's a design effort within that process, but not always. Sometimes it's just selection process.
Well, being at the level you are now, I'm sure, you know, going into that shortlist, you have to see a lot of the same people. I'd imagine the bigs are in the room, the OMAs are in the room. You know, now in 2021, what is it that kind of sets Snohetta apart when you're going into that final pitch? This is why we're on Arc Record, Elaine, where we bring out all of these questions. You know, your eyes, I saw them light up.
I don't know what anyone else's pitch is like, so it's hard to say. we try to be very sincere and who we are. We're just who we are. We're not putting on a show. We try to get to know people and have a truly collaborative conversation. Architects pursue a lot more work than they actually get. And that's pretty normal. So it really isn't about winning or losing, because we usually lose more than we win.
Well, before we dive too far into the nitty gritty of Snohetta, we're going to go way back here. And we have a shared experience. We both are graduates of the University of Texas at Austin. But can you just take us through kind of where you grew up, kind of what your parents did, the economics of the household, and out of all the things in life you could have done, why the heck architecture?
Gosh. Well, I'm from El Paso, Texas. Father was a pharmacist. I don't know if you've been to El Paso, but it's in the desert, the very end of the Rocky Mountain Range, barrels right through the middle of the city.
I think it's always
the Mexican border.
It's always so interesting about people. You know, when you think of architecture, you think Chicago, you think New York. El Paso is not really on the list. So I think it's always interesting of people that really don't have great examples of architecture growing up. They go on to be like very well-established architects. Just a side note.
Well, El Paso has an incredibly rich architectural history. It has a lot of work by the architect Henry Troost, who came out of the Chicago school and worked prolifically in the Southwest and has built some of El Paso's greatest buildings. There's a wonderful example of modern architecture by Sidney Eisenstadt, who designed a synagogue in El Paso. There's the beautiful Crest buildings. There's a tremendous architectural legacy in El Paso amongst, you know, the historic buildings. So I grew up quite influenced by that, but without really knowing that architecture was a profession. It didn't really register as something that I could do. Like many architects, I was always drawing and making things. And my father's hobby was woodworking, and I was always shadowing him in the workshop. So I gained an understanding of how things go together and craft. That was, I think, an influence. He was a pharmacist. I was always been interested in science and medicine and those kinds of things as well. I was a serious ballet student. I think I had quite a lot of interests, a wide variety of interests. And by the time I went off to college, I didn't really know. I didn't have a clear idea of what I wanted to do. But I went to Texas Christian University, and there in Fort Worth, Texas, as you know, is the Kimball Art Museum by Lou Kahn. I didn't know anything about Lou Kahn, but I used to spend a lot of weekends at the Kimball, you know, with friends playing around in the garden and the grounds and going to the galleries. And it didn't really register either that was what, you know, architects did. But I was taking a drawing class also at school, and it was taught by an architect. And he recognized that I had a facility for drawing, and he talked to me about pursuing architecture. And then, you know, I wasn't connecting the dots, but at some point the dots connected. And when I realized that the Kimball Art Museum was something that architects could aspire to do, I got hooked. And then I transferred to UT Austin because they had a program.
Yeah, and it's a pretty good program, constantly ranked, you know, top 10 for their undergrad program. But you came out of there, 1989, you go to work for Snøhetta, again in Oslo. Snøhetta in 1989, I'd imagine, is not the name that it is in 2021. So can you take us through coming out of, you know, UT? Michael Benedict, who is a shared acquaintance of ours, he has to talk. Everyone wants to know about Craig Dykers. He's like Mr. UT, you know? And he said, you know, he was in my studio. This is Michael talking now. So just a picture, like a South African accent and, you know, me being about 7 inches shorter. But he was saying that he could tell him as a student that he was different than other students coming through the program. So 1989, I'm sure you have other options. You go to work for this small little startup. I'm assuming that's what it was at the time. Can you take us through what it was at that moment when you started and what made you kind of say, like, I'm going to go ahead and see this one through?
Well, when I graduated in 1988, and I went to Los Angeles to work. Craig was already working there and doing his own thing. And I was, you know, working on small apartment buildings in a smallish sized firm. And Craig had a friend who was interested in doing this competition. Craig was interested in doing this competition. Craig's friend had a friend who was interested in doing this competition. And that group got together. And I wanted to participate in that design team competition. And that's what I did. So our friends' friends came from Norway to Los Angeles and congregated there in an apartment and worked on this competition. I guess we rolled it up and sent it off, and there were some sort of loose plans made about, well, what if we win? You know, what would we do? and so it kind of happened like that. I didn't really think about what it meant to just pick up and move to another country, other than, you know, the prospect of being part of this really great piece of work for, you know, to work on a contemporary version of the Library of Alexandria. That was amazing. And compared to the work that I was doing, it was a very easy decision to make. And looking back, I think I spent the first half of my adult life outside of my home country, and that's probably one of the best things I could have ever done.
How much of that did that play a role in
you know, because there's obviously different economic systems at play in Norway than there is in the US. So in starting the firm, for example, we had Joshua Ramos of used to be of OMA, now of Rex. And he was saying, you know, when they were in Rotterdam, it was kind of, you know, they didn't have to think about health insurance and all this stuff. And then when they started their New York office, all of a sudden, all this like stuff that you had to do played a role in it. Was that kind of, did that help or assist or hinder any way of actually getting this firm up and going? And what was that moment when you kind of realized like, oh, we're really onto something here?
Well, to back up to the first part of your question, I think as a group of fairly young people working together, pursuing work together, I don't believe that any of us had the mindset of being employers and setting up a firm in that way. And there is a lot of infrastructure in Scandinavia set up, which alleviates a lot of that individual pressure on setting up things like insurance and healthcare. So we didn't really have that burden. And in the early 90s, the economy in Norway was pretty rough and we didn't have a lot going on. And we spent a lot of the months without paychecks, but still working and doing competitions and trying to get things off the ground. It took 4 years and a little bit to get a contract for the work in Egypt for the library. So there was a lot of negotiating, there were politics, you know, all kinds of things happened. And the Norwegian government, through the foreign department, I believe, awarded us a grant. I guess you could say the equivalent of a grant, which was $500,000 to carry out some feasibility studies, proof of concept work with engineers and others for the competition to help further the process of solidifying a contract. Now, I don't believe that would have happened in this country or many others.
Just for the second part, you know, was there a time or anything where you really realized that this was actually happening, this was a firm, this is a business, and you don't need to worry about stuff coming in? Or is it just architecture, you always have to worry about stuff coming in?
Yeah, of course, every day. I think maybe a decade later, we won another anonymous international competition for the Oslo Opera House. And I think at that moment, I was thinking, we're not a one-hit wonder. It was kind of like getting struck by lightning the first time. It's kind of winning the opera competition is like getting struck by lightning a second time. And around that period of time, we were starting to get invited to more selective competitions. And we were losing a lot of them, but we were losing to people like Frank Gehry and Norman Foster, and, you know, which I thought was great. I considered that a success, you know, that we had kind of moved up a bit, even though we weren't, you know, completely there yet. It felt like we had solid ground beneath us.
I want to talk about now just a few of your projects. And what I really appreciate about the work at Snøhetta is that it's not overly complicated. It's intriguing, but it's not like a in your face, unavoidable sort of situation, if that makes sense. And one I have to give major props to is the SF MoMA, just because I could only imagine what some of those schemes looked like, you know what I mean, coming at it. And from the outside, it's geometric, but it's elegant. And it's not trying to stand out and be the picture of the SF MoMA. Like, it's almost, you don't even realize that that's the same building in a way, just because the entryway of the SF MoMA is kind of, it's really distinct. So can you kind of take us through, and then we can go through some other ones too. I mean, also on the flip side, there is also Under, which is your underwater restaurant, which I think was probably the most publicized project I've ever seen when researching architecture. So those two things are really dramatically different. But they're both very simple concepts. So can you take us through kind of some of these design elements or design processes, if you can, and just what really working at Snøhetta, what is sort of the design focus or going into a project? What are you really looking to accomplish?
Well, thank you for SF MoMA was a really a challenging task because the Mario Botta building is so iconic. It has such a strong identity with the red brick and the, you know, the striped skylight, the oculus. And it really is just a very, very robust and strong. And adding on to that is felt almost impossible. And the site was very constrained. It was, you know, like a kind of a long and narrow from one block to the other, a through block situation behind the Botta building. And so, and quite a lot of square footage. It was a big project, and it was, you know, that's like, how do you add on to something that's so iconic? You almost can't. And the identity of the design that we created is very different from the Mario Botta building. And I think the museum itself, SF MoMA, wanted to have a more transparent relationship to the neighborhood. So when the Mario Botta building was completed in 1995, that part of San Francisco was still a little bit rough. And the building is very inwardly focused. It's very protective of its contents. And by the time we did the expansion, that neighborhood had really flourished, in part due to it having a museum in that location. And so our task was to create a new identity for the institution that was about connecting, more open-armed, if you will. So there's a lot of transparency at street level. There's a free gallery at street level that's surrounded by glass. You don't have to buy a ticket to go in and have that experience. As you navigate through the galleries, there's a lot of light that comes in from this directly light windows, light and view that come in through the side galleries. So, and there's balconies. You can step outside and enjoy a green wall and outdoor sculpture.
Is it the largest? I could be wrong with this. Is it one of the largest living walls? Am I wrong?
Yeah, it maybe was in 2016 for a hot second.
Okay. And
I think it's been surpassed.
Outdoor balcony, as a MoMA, living wall, outside, light coming
I think I was rambling.
Okay. Well, compare that to the design process of Under, which is a very, I feel like looking at it, I don't mean this in a bad way, but mm-hmm. it's like a student project. Like, wouldn't it be cool if this whole restaurant was underwater? And you all just like, let's do it. This is what we're doing. So those two things, yeah. Again, one is very like, you know, let's mm-hmm. be observant to, you know, the surroundings and the existing building. Yeah. The other one's like, underwater restaurant, here we go. So could you kind of compare and contrast those two?
Sure. I think I wasn't on the design team for Under, so I think that's important to clarify. And the original site is not exactly where the building is today. It was the restaurant, the chef and the restaurant itself that wanted an underwater restaurant. So that, you know, that was the challenge, how to do that. So the site, the building was relocated, not too far away, to a place that is very much surrounded by the natural landscape, by the coastline, as opposed to too close to the rest of the other developments. You know, it's a very straightforward construction, and Norway is certainly well known for building tunnels, and the actual technology for building this and having it submerged in water was not a particularly extraordinary technical challenge for a country that does build so many tunnels underwater and through mountains. But it's, you know, it's kind of like a human aquarium. You know, I think you just take the bull by the horns and develop a really strong idea that is robust and powerful, and you just go for it. And this has a lot of aspects to it that aren't immediately obvious. For example, the way the surface of the concrete is treated below the water so that it supports underwater life or mollusks. And it, you know, because as a piece of construction, it has displaced life below ground where it sits. And so it's giving that opportunity back. And there's also research that is conducted on that marine life around it. So it has multiple functions.
There seems to be a notion, especially amongst younger architects, of creating an object for the sake of having an object. And now you're one of these firms that is clearly one of the world leaders. And we've talked about some things are a little more, stand out a little bit more than other buildings that you've done. So where do you all stand on this architecture as an object, architecture as a form-driven piece of architecture, architecture as spectacle, if you mm-hmm. if you will.
Well, we are not only architects. We also have landscape architects and interior designers and product designers, graphic designers in our firm. So we avail ourselves of a variety of viewpoints, which I think is incredibly important, critical, in fact. And I think it's also important to note that architecture does not exist in a vacuum. The landscape around it does not exist in a vacuum either. They coexist, they influence each other. So I don't really know how to answer in that way. The idea of spectacle in architecture certainly is not new. I just think of the pyramids or, you know, the Taj Mahal or Petra. You know, there's cathedrals. It's always been there, and they're representative of different qualities. It might be power, politics, spirituality, or love. You know, and I think they're representative of who we are as a society. And maybe, you know, a million years from now, and when we're not here anymore, and others come and see what we've done, you know, it's kind of like showing your best in a way.
And not to step back and just run through every project that Snohetta has ever done, but there's one that just was released a few months ago. And maybe it's because I'm in Austin, but it seems like it's not controversial, but it's people either love it or they hate it. And that's the addition to the Blanton, which for those of you listening that don't know the story of the Blanton, this is the way it's been told to me, is essentially Herzog and de Meuron was supposed to do the Blanton Museum at the University of Texas at Austin. And then one of the regents at the university had an issue because it did not have a red clay tile roof that would match the existing campus. And so they fired them. And then a friend of the regent got hired. I've heard all these rumors about it. But it's no SF MoMA, we'll say, the Blanton Museum. And now you're doing an addition on the entryway. It's these large sort of leaf-like figures coming out of the ground. Can you take us through the design process, what you're trying to do? And you're designing at your alma mater. What was that whole process like?
Well, probably what you don't know is back when Herzog and de Meuron was selected to design the Blanton, we had also been shortlisted and interviewed for that.
So it's kind of like coming full circle. Like, you should have done it. You had your opportunity 20 years ago.
they left the project, and then it became something else entirely than what they had envisioned. And the Blanton today exists in two buildings with the courtyard in between. And it has, as a museum, it has suffered from low visibility, a weak identity, not in terms of its collection or its power as a museum, but as a physical place. You know, it blends in with all of the other campus buildings. It could be mistaken for a classroom building. And if you're not familiar with the campus and have been, you know, there frequently, you can't find the door. It's very difficult for new visitors to find the door. So that, you know, none of those are good for a museum. And the Blanton has a really powerful collection. And it's such a great institution. And, you know, when I was a student, the art collection was dispersed in more than one place. So there was the Harry Ransom Center. There was a collection over in the art building. So if you kind of had to know your way around if you wanted to find the art on campus. Fortunately, the Harry Ransom Center was right behind Sutton Hall, the architecture building. So that was easy. But now they're kind of consolidated. And I think the Kelly Pavilion, Kelly's Austin, is just amazing and a wonderful piece to have there. So I think what we were trying to do, many things. One is to create a strong identity for the building, to lend clarity to the entrance and ease of access, create shade. It's very important to have the versatility in the courtyard to be able to have events, different kinds of events, to have space to erect a tent or, you know, whatever that might be, and a place for people to use the courtyard on a daily basis. And to you know, really underscore the fact that you feel like you're at the museum before you even enter the building. You know, the museum has extended its reach beyond its physical borders. And that's important because it I think being on the edge of campus where it is on MLK needs to have that dual identity of being part of the campus, but also being a civic institution. One of the things that those petals do is frame its relationship to the city by creating a kind of implied arch as you look down Congress towards the Capitol. it also connects in a similar way to the Kelly Pavilion. So it's doing a lot of things.
I mentioned earlier as I brought this up that people either love it or they hate it. And I've seen a lot of comparisons to Confluence Park by Lake Flato down in San Antonio, which is like this arch concrete structure that captures rain and does all these sort of things. When you're designing such a building that is visible to the public, engaged in the public, and then you hear feedback that is less than ideal, not from everyone, but from some people, how does that play into both the process, the work, the next project, everything?
We approach our work from a stance of generosity and inclusiveness and creating places that foster social interaction and are improvements to the built environment and the natural environment, restoring and respecting habitats as much as we can. And also, there really is no architecture without a client, and the client mission is important. And we look for clients who have, you know, where there's some degree of mission alignment or a sharing of values in the work that they want to produce. But, you know, helping create identity through design is going to take you to a place that is not experienced the same by everyone.
So I want to shift gears here a little bit, because we've talked a lot about the work you've done, you know, your background and everything. You started the New York office for Snohetta, and you have multiple offices throughout the world. So one, can you take us through that process of founding the New York office? And then two, when you're trying to create a consistent portfolio of this is the work that Snohetta does, but you're doing it over, you know, multiple offices, what is that whole process like? How do you kind of get like a quality control?
Yeah, well, we have 7 studios, and six of them are, well, let's, yeah, our New York and San Francisco studios are together as one company. So I just consider that as one. But all of our studios are led by people who once sat in the same studio and worked together, worked with each other in some way or over some period of time. And I think it, in our company, I like to refer to it as a design diaspora. You know, our founders have very strong and shared values about the built environment and about design. And I think that kind of permeates through everybody, through all of us. We have a very inclusive design process where we have a lot of voices in the room at the beginning of the design process. So it's not a top-down hierarchy in terms of design. So an intern, a student, an engineer, architects and landscape architects, interior designers of all stages in their career can have input in how we develop our ideas together. And I think that's common to all of our studios.
And now that Snohetta is kind of within the term, within the world of architecture, is kind of a household name, we'll say, how has that kind of changed how the firm functions and how you do your work? And is there this sort of added pressure that you have?
Not really. I mean, there's always pressure. There are always daily pressures of keeping everything running and everybody happy. And I think that exists regardless of your standing in the architectural community. You know, I think the goals and standards that we aspire to are not dependent on that either. They are who we want to be and what we want our work to be comes from inside. It's not generated by outside influence or pressure. Recognition is wonderful and it's important, but it's not the driver.
There are a number of young architects that come work for you. I know that UT has a 6-month internship. A lot of young portfolios come through. And I think what is interesting about young architects and the use of precedents, in my mind, I get very frustrated with precedents because I feel like oftentimes it's like 7 projects that are just merged into one and then they call it their building because of precedents. Do you see an influx of people with the portfolios coming in to you? Do you see that there's just young architects that are kind of imitating Snohetta or trying to do Snohetta-esque projects? Because I could imagine, like, for example, with a company like Frank Gehry, for example, where it's hinged on one person, or David Adjaye. Are you just imitating Frank Gehry, or is that, what comes first, I guess? Is it kind of a chicken and the egg sort of scenario?
Well, there are many ways to answer that question. We get a lot of applicants and a lot from students and young graduates, new graduates. And I think knowing your audience for a portfolio is important. You know, editing, being able to edit. Sometimes they are incredibly long and dense and thick. So it's the message gets lost. So a portfolio is a series of decisions that say a lot about who you are and about the choices you've made and what you're putting forward, what you're, you know, what you're showing other people. And sometimes it's just a dump of everything that someone did in school and without any kind of hierarchy or curation. So it's really hard to get a read about of who they are because, and that's really that's what they're presenting as a first impression.
That's interesting. I, prior to architecture school, I was in comedy and I was sitting with Pauly Shore over all the people at a buffet in Reno. The story just goes more and more downhill the more I talk. Well, he was asking me about my set and I was like, oh, I got to talk about this. I got to talk about that. And he was like, you know, in very like, yo, bro, like very Pauly sort of way. He was saying that, you know, it's not about being funny. It's about telling people who you are because they could leave the show saying like, oh, that guy was kind of funny. And then they forget about you in 2 days. But if they know who you are, then they really have a sense of what you're about. And that makes you more memorable in a way. Is it the same sort of
It's the same sort of thing. And one thing I always want to know from people when I interview them is, well, what did you learn from doing that project? What was important about your thesis project? What didn't work out? You know, I want the genuine experience. I don't want the impression that everything was perfect because school is about learning. And if you can't make mistakes in school, then that's, you know, that's not good.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
That's rough. I don't know if I've had any one moment. I think I have, you know, a lot of mini moments every day or frequently. But I think being able to establish a U.S. practice and bring it to a position of success is a source of pride for me.
What's the biggest setback you've had in your career and how have you kind of used that to get to where you are today?
2020, I would say, was a setback for all of us, for our practice. It's been so hard to be separated from everyone, to realize that people are feeling isolated or they're not able to learn by observation or overhearing how someone else is dealing with a situation in the studio. That connection is not with us right now. And I think that I see that as a tremendous setback. I think there have been good lessons learned, you know, that we've realized there's a lot more versatility in how we can work and where we can work from. And
what are some of the things from this last year? You know, you've talked about this implementing so many changes that you think are going to carry forward past 2020, 2021.
Yeah, I think greater flexibility in terms of working from home. While we do, I think, need each other to collaborate in a very hands-on way, and we will always need that. I think having the possibility to work from home when that makes sense is good. Right now, we currently have more people than physically fit in our studio. So that's also been possible this year in a way that we maybe wouldn't have immediately thought before.
If you could sit down and have a cup of coffee with any architect, it could be of this generation or past generation, who would it be and why?
I think it would have to be Imhotep. I think I would have to go all the way back to the beginning. He's generally referred to as the first architect and is responsible for the stepped pyramid at Saqqara for the pharaoh Zoser. And I think they obviously had a great collaboration, but I think I just want to go all the way back as far as I could.
Knowing what you know now, and, you know, being through all the experiences that you've been through, what would you say to, you know, young Elaine sitting in Sutton Hall over at the University of Texas? What would you say to the young architect that wants to have the type of career that you've had?
Get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because my career has been a series of firsts, and hindsight has been my most powerful mentor. So I think you're never going to, whatever the task is, it may not be in your comfort zone, and that you have to be okay with that. Otherwise, you don't make progress. Be prepared to reinvent yourself over the course of your career.
Last question. What's next for Snohetta?
What's next for Snohetta? I don't know. I mean, I started my career kind of by walking into the unknown. And I think being bold enough to face uncertain futures, you know, I think is where we need to be.
Well, Elaine Molinar, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with me. I thought this was great. I hope you did too. And I think our audience will as well. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Aaron. It was a lot of fun.
Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, a podcast by Architectural Record. If you enjoyed this episode, we would appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast, give us a rating, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.